Welcome today. I'm tempted to call this a special session of the Nevada Court of Appeals. It's not really a special session, but it's very special to us today, and hopefully to all of you, because this is the first time we've had amicus curiae appearing in a case and also arguing a case. So I hope everybody liked that idea. We came up with this plan on how the argument would be organized, and Kurt Jensen, our clerk of the court, has passed this out to you, so hopefully this works for everyone. We try to go through all the various possibilities of the most efficient and profitable use of the time, and this is what we came up with. So this is case 75688, Schuler versus AdArt Inc., and this is the time set for the oral argument. I'm joined today with Judge Jerry Tao to my right and Judge Bonnie Bulla to my left. We have the appellant going first, and Mr. Brensky is going to be doing the opening argument, and then we'll proceed from there. And you'll notice that we even gave respondent the chance for a rebuttal time, but apparently that's not going to be used. So, Mr. Hunter, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So we'll just take it then. And Mr. Brensky, 3 minutes. Is that what you want to reserve for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you'll have a red light and also a reminder from me if we get to that point. You can have more time if it turns out that you want to reserve more time if you stop with a greater amount of time than 3 minutes left. All right. We have a question that we submitted to everyone and to Amicus for purposes of the briefing, but in terms of the argument, appellant and respondent are free to raise any arguments that have been discussed in the briefs. So you're not restricted to that one question, but obviously that question is of primary concern to us, or we wouldn't be going through this process. So those are the ground rules. We have an hour set aside for this, so I think we're all going to know a heck of a lot more about products liability law when we're done with this case. All right, the appellant may proceed then.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel.
May it please the court, what this court does today will help determine the amount of justice that the citizens of Nevada will get with regards to product liability. If the court makes a determination that there's a very strict line with regards to what a product is, that will prevent innumerable citizens of the state from getting justice. And that's the most important issue that we see in this case. In this case, the appellant, Mr. Schuler, was repairing an LED in a cabinet of a product manufactured by the respondent, a California corporation that makes signs. While he's enclosed in that sign, he takes a step, he falls 150 feet. He survives, which is the best part of the case. What happened in this case is that the court, the lower court, denied a motion for summary judgment on the issue of products liability, granted a motion for summary judgment on premises liability, saying it's a products case, then later on reversed its decision and said it's not a products case. And it used the cases of the three cases that are mentioned. I believe it's Callaway, Martins, and Dayberry. And I probably also believe Pat. So what the court is asking us to do is to give it some guidance as to how to define what a defective product is for the purpose of strict liability. Well, it's very simple that the purpose of imposing strict liability on a manufacturer of a product is to make it easier to prove that a remote manufacturer did something, like this respondent in California. Also, to spread the loss, the cost of the damage to the people that have been injured by using a product as the liable entity. And the most important is to promote the safety of the product being used in interstate commerce. In this particular case, there is no question that the respondent's product is an interstate commerce product. It went from, it was assembled, it was designed, manufactured in California, shipped to Nevada, and assembled here in Nevada to put on top of the pylon, the building that is the base of the sign. Now, why is this product that we have here before you today, why is that within the definition of a product? Well, it was prefabricated out of state and installed by the manufacturer. Two, it entered the stream of commerce, obviously, by being created in California and assembled here in Nevada. The respondent's business, its primary business, is making signs. It's the product that it produces. The respondent is uniquely in a position to be aware of whatever pitfalls, probably a bad word, but good for this case, there may be in the sign itself. In other words, this particular sign failed to have any kind of warning that if you walk on this portion of the floor, you're going to fall through it. Only the manufacturer of that sign knows that. Mr. Bueller, who went up there to simply make some repairs on an LED panel, had no idea. Frankly, the MGM probably had no idea. That whoever the contractor was that built the pylon had no idea. The only entity that would be able to warn Mr. Bueller is not to walk on this part of the floor was the respondent.
So what does it matter to your argument at all that this is at least arguably, if not pretty clearly, a one-of-a-kind thing? I mean, no one else in the world is going to have an MGM sign. I'm presuming if they did, MGM would sue them for infringement of their trademark and copyright. So it's going to be a one-of-a-kind thing. Does that matter to your argument?
Not at all. And this is why. Because every sign that the respondent makes is a one-of-a-kind, unique sign. In other words, it's a sign. The Stardust sign, the MGM sign, every sign that's made is going to be designed for whatever particular purpose that the purchaser is getting. So if you said that if a one-of-a-kind item would not be subject to product liability, you would say that a Tesla 3, it's a unique to Teslas, therefore it couldn't be a product.
Well, it's unique to Teslas, but Tesla makes thousands of them.
And Tesla's liable as a product manufacturer.
Right. But this sign, you know, they're not making, this company, Adar's not making, as I understand it, not making thousands of MGM signs. They made one, right?
So if we follow that logic, then if you make any kind of a product that goes through interstate commerce, as long as it's unique to that customer, then you've got no liability. And I don't think that's what this court has said in Callaway, and I certainly don't think that's what the restatement says. The restatement says a product is a tangible personal property distributed commercially for use or consumption. This falls directly within that definition.
Mr. Brunsky, the definition that you read, is that from the third restatement?
It is.
Is that the definition you believe that we should adopt or look at adopting in this case?
Absolutely.
And how does that serve the public policy interests of allowing someone to bring a products liability claim?
Well, it helps define what a product is. And the law, the judge determines whether or not it's a product. The jury does not make that determination. It's a gatekeeper issue that the judge must make a decision on. So in other words, the Callaway court followed the second restatement, and if the third restatement was in effect at the time the Callaway decision was made, then I think there may well be a definition of that it was a product in that case also.
So let me ask you the next question then. Under that third restatement definition that you just recited, it includes the word it's personal property. But
yes.
This, as I understand it, was a sign that was installed with, you know, diggers and backhoes and bulldozers, and you can't really move it without diggers and backhoes. So at what point is it no longer personal property and it becomes a structure?
Well, that's an excellent question, Your Honor. And if you looked at third restatement on the definition of product, it says other items such as real property are products when the context, within the context of their distribution and use, if it's sufficiently analogous to the distribution and use of tangible personal property, that is appropriate to apply rules stated in this restatement. So the restatement third indicates that real property can and should be subject to a product.
Sure. If some things are fixtures, but you can also remove them, right? If I get a chandelier installed in my house, it's not that hard for me to take it down if I have a little bit of basic knowledge and sell it to my neighbor if I don't like it anymore. But I'm not doing that with a 100-foot-tall pylon sign, right? I mean, at some point, yes, what I'm saying is this chandelier right here, as installed right now, most people would call it a fixture. But it can be removed, and then it becomes a personal, becomes a product. But a 100-foot pylon sign, how is that analogy, how does that analogy work?
Well, I think it works because when you're looking at this pylon, the pylon is not defective. It's the sign cabinet at the top, like the chandelier. The cabinet at the top of this pylon is manufactured just like this chandelier is manufactured somewhere else. And then it's attached to this building. So that's what happened in this case. We had a cabin, the portion of the sign on top, manufactured somewhere else, transported through interstate commerce without anyone having the understanding or the ability to know that the floor, portions of the floor could not be walked on. The simple remedy is to warn the person or the user that that is a defect because it's a failure to warn. So that's important, because the only entity, as I said earlier, I don't want to repeat myself too much, the only entity that could prevent this tragedy from happening is the responder. No one else could have done
that. Does it make any difference that the respondent has gone through several different corporate changes over the years, and this happened in the early 90s when this was manufactured?
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor, and the lower court denied that motion on that issue because they used the factors in, I believe, the Sullivan case, and that wasn't addressed in this court because we did not lose on that issue.
Okay. Of course, we're primarily interested in defining a product, so that's what we're focused on. I'm sure there'll be if this case stays alive, there'll be a lot of other issues that'll still be litigated.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's no doubt that this is the one hurdle in a long race. But that's why we're here, and we're glad to be here and to assist the court in. And regardless of what happens with the court's decision concerning any other issues in this case, the court in this particular case is going to help determine who gets redress in the state of Nevada forever.
So your reply brief, the most recent one, had screenshots or pictures put into the brief, which looked pretty clever. But are these items all in the record?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. Everything that's contained in our briefs are part of the record.
Okay, so you've indicated that the sign at the Rio, the sign at Treasure Island, these are ad art signs?
Yes, Your Honor. Which helps you to realize that this is not a one-off. This is not something that someone makes just as an aside. This is their business. This is what ad art does. They make signs. They put them on top of pillars. That's their business. Now, what's important is to why a building or something is not defined as a sign or as a product. And the Callaway Court goes through a litany of reasons why they determined strict product liability shouldn't be applied with regards to this leaky roof issue. And I'm just going to go over them very briefly. A builder cannot easily limit his liability by express warranties. I really don't know what that means, but it's in there, so I wrote it. The purchaser has an opportunity to make a meaningful inspection of the property. So they don't want to give, Callaway didn't want to give strict product liability because there's privity of contract in a lot of this stuff, and there's no such privity of contract in a tort.
And this, by way of warning, you're under 3 minutes, so it's up to you when you want to wrap that up.
I'll wrap it up on rebuttal. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Brinsky. All right, Mr. Hunter.
I don't want to drink Mr. Brinsky's water. May it please the court. My name is Timothy Hunter, and I represent the respondent in this matter, AdArt. The district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of AdArt because the policy considerations that were developed for determining products liability, strict products liability, do not apply to the MGM pylon sign. Now, counsel made the distinction between the pylon and the cabinet. That's the first I've heard of any distinction made between this sign being more than one complete piece from the bottom up that goes well above 200 feet and has been at the MGM since 1993 or 1994. It was originally constructed with the green sheen for the Wizard of Oz theme going along with the MGM Grand. And it originally had a rotating cube on the top, first of its kind. That cube is no longer there, of course. But that goes to show the uniqueness of this particular sign and why it was custom built. And it was built with the MGM in mind. It was built for the entire theme of the MGM in 93 or 94 to go not only just from the casino, but also to the MGM pylon sign. Because they wanted it to flow, they wanted it to be unique, they wanted it to set itself aside from everything else in the on the Las Vegas Strip. Because that's what we do on the Las Vegas Strip. We make things bigger, we make things better. We promote them so that people from all over the world come by. The MGM Grand, and with it, the pylon, they're one and the same. It was an improvement on real property. Now, counsel made the distinction earlier about whether or not he wanted to adopt the third restatement. But when you look at comment L to the restatement, it specifically states, traditionally courts have been reluctant to impose products liability on sellers of improved real property and that such property does not constitute good or personalty. I actually had to look up what personalty meant, but it's personal movable property. So they did not want it to apply to real property. They wanted it things that were part of the land, which this is. It's part of the land.
Mr. Hunter, would it be a fair statement, though, that the sign could be removed from the land?
The sign, you would have to take the entire sign down over a period of months. And even then, no, a portion of the sign would still be there because it has foundations. It would essentially be like if you had a home and you wanted to change out the entire home. You would have to demolish it, but you would still have the slab there. So if you really wanted to do it, you would have to, even destroy the slab.
Is there any argument, though, that the appellant fell from that portion of the sign that could be taken down and removed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the piece of the sign that he fell from is a material called a locobond. And it's a piece of aluminum, and then a piece of rubber, and then another piece of aluminum. That particular piece is the outside sheen, the green, of the MGM pylon sign. So it's throughout the entire thing. It is an indivisible part of the MGM pylon.
And that piece of material that was used in the MGM sign, is that, I say alcubond, I might not be pronouncing that correctly, but is that used in other signs manufactured by AdArt?
I believe so. There may have been a reference. My client during his deposition, which is in the record, did state that he was familiar with the product, but he didn't go into any great detail about whether it was used in other signs. He just said that he was aware of the product when asked about it.
But the sign itself, including this the box part of the sign, as we've referred to it as, and the pylon part, was all manufactured by AdArt in California and shipped over.
Well, counsel makes the distinction that it was made and prefabricated in California and then brought here. I will admit, the pieces and parts of it were manufactured in California and brought to Nevada. But when you use the term, and when you look at the term prefabricated in other locations, where products liability is involved. They use the term prefabricated as it pertains to things like prefabricated homes, where you're making hundreds, if not thousands, of the exact same home, and you're doing it with the same design, and then you're shipping it to the location, and you essentially just need to drop it there. That's not the case here. From the record, this took months to not only build, but to assemble. A prefabricated home would be more like an automobile, where there's an assembly line. That is not the case as it pertains to the MGM pylon sign here. There's also a discussion about justice, and would justice be served by finding that the...
Let me just pick up on you talked about comment L to the third restatement, which is an interesting comment, because it's kind of the hard one we're here. You know, this case is about line drawing. Right? What's the difference between a product and anything else? So the example that Commonell uses, it distinguishes between real property and personal property, right? But at some level, that line's a little blurry than you think. I came up with the example of the chandelier, but maybe that wasn't the best example. Let's say I buy a brick. I go to Home Depot and buy a brick. While I'm standing at Home Depot with it in my hand, it's clearly a product. It's personal property. It's in my hand. I go to my house. I cement it into a wall. At some point after the cement dries, most people would say, well, now it's become a part of real property. But where was that line, and what's the definition? Where would you put the line between one and the other? When a product becomes not a product, or when something that's real property becomes personal property, or vice versa?
Well, I'll point you to the holding of an Illinois Court of Appeals opinion, Martins versus MCL, where they address this very issue. And in that case, an individual similar to Mr. Schuler here, fell from a steel beam. They found that steel beam was an indivisible part of the building and therefore was not subject to strict liability under a theory of products. They went on and said, based upon the policy considerations supporting the strict liability doctrine, courts have consistently held that buildings and indivisible component parts of the building structures, and then they specifically referred to bricks, supporting beams, and railings are not deemed products. So using that very example, Your Honor, a brick that was implemented into a home, you would have had to have cemented it, put it on top of another brick with another brick on top of it. It becomes an indivisible part of the home and is therefore no longer a product. Similar to the steel beam in MCL, MCL Construction Corp., and similar to the Alokabon piece that Mr. Schuler is alleging that is defective. It was an essential part of an indispensable part. It's directly comparable to a brick because it makes up the exterior sheathing of the MGM pylon. It's not something that can just be removed and replaced. The examples you see, and I would have no issue if someone found that a dishwasher or an oven was a product for the purposes of strict liability when it was placed in a home. I myself have had someone come out, they pulled my dishwasher out, took it away, put a new one in. That I could see as not being a product. But if someone told me that the bricks on the outside of my home were a product, that's not the case. And that issue has been dealt with in the past.
Mr. Hunter, the Callaway decision, would you not acknowledge that that decision was decided on an economic loss doctrine and that the discussion on products liability, for the most part, is in dicta?
I would not agree with that.
Okay.
I would say that there was a large discussion on the case as it pertains to the economic loss doctrine. It was later overruled on that ground. But that does not mean that the strict products liability issue was not at play in that case. And usually if you have something in dicta, in my experience, it's generally just a paragraph or so. But the fact of the matter is the Nevada Supreme Court went to great depths in determining what was a product and doing this analysis on why a townhome was not considered a product for the basis of strict liability. So I believe that is controlling Nevada precedent. It's interesting to me that it happened in 2000, so it was even after the third restatement. But whether you look at Callaway, where you look at the second restatement or the third restatement, the policy considerations are all the same. And those policy considerations show that the MGM pylon was not a product for the purposes of strict liability.
You think that Callaway possibly is just restricted to its facts, considering the parties that remained in the case at that point in time compared to the original parties and some of the language the Supreme Court used there about talking about the facts of this case and this type of case? And that's usually an indicator that a broad rule is not intended.
Well, the Nevada Supreme Court could only address what was put in front of them, similar to what you can only put in or decide what's put in front of you in this circumstances. And in that determination, it happened to be a framer, I believe. And they went into great detail about that framer and the leaks and why. But then they expanded it, and they discussed a townhome in general. They didn't really go into one specific component part of it, but they discussed townhomes in general and how the fact that even though there may be hundreds of thousands of townhomes, each one is unique because of the interplay of the parties that are involved, the soils involved, the designer and the builders involved, and things of that nature. And for that reason, they determined a townhome was not a product. When you take that, considering hundreds, maybe even hundreds of thousands of townhomes have been built around Nevada, and they determined that wasn't a product, how could you then take that and say that the MGM pylon was a product here? Because it is. It's one of a kind. It was made based upon design elements that were put in place by MGM. If you read the deposition of my client, he had an individual that he was reporting to the entire time about the design and construction of the MGM pylon sign, an individual by the name of Fred Berenger. And he was reporting directly to the owner and developer, Kirk Kevorkian, the billionaire who was originally responsible for the construction of the MGM pylon. So they were completely involved in everything that was going on.
But AdArt ultimately made the decision to manufacture the sign at its facility in California and used, I'm assuming, techniques that AdArt was familiar with in making these types of signs, because AdArt does have a catalog that says this, you know, these are our products, and in that catalog are signs. So it's difficult to reconcile that with your position that this is not the type of product to which products liability should apply.
Well, first of all, as it pertains to the use of the word product on their website, people use words all the time thinking, I know what that word means. And they very well may know what that word means. But when you look at it from a legal perspective, they don't know what it means. People use the word negligence freely these days, saying essentially to say that someone's at fault. But me, being an attorney, when I hear negligence, I think duty, breach, causation, damages. I don't think just fault. And because it's a legal term, it's for the court to determine duty. So essentially, you would be allowing my client to make a legal conclusion, even though they're not attorneys, they're sign builders, on what is and is not a product. Now, I understand your consideration that they do make signs. But simply because they make signs doesn't mean that it is a product. This is an improvement on real property. You can't just buy this sign. No one could just come up to MGM. Well, I guess they could, but then they'd have to buy that piece of land that the sign is on. If you want that sign, you buy the MGM grant. They're one and the same. If you look at it today...
Well, why can't you just buy the same sign from AdArt and have it installed somewhere else?
You can't. There's.
But you don't put MGM on it. You put Caesars on it or something else. But you can have an identical. I mean, let me just ask you that as a factual question. Could someone buy the identical sign but just for a different industry, Caesars or, you know, Regal Cinemas or something like that, but in all other respects the sign is the same? Or are you saying that literally AdArt made this one sign not just totally apart from the MGM words, but the whole structure design? They made one, and they will never make one ever again.
Yes, Your Honor, they made one, and they will only make one ever again.
So even if I went in there and asked for one that said Caesars on it, or had my name on it, because I wanted my, you know, sign on my front yard, because my ego is that big, they would refuse to do it?
I think they would make whatever product that you wanted, but making an identical MGM pylon sign would be, you know, given the individuals that were involved, essentially you would be saying, I want the identical sign. But then these same identical people aren't going to be able to, aren't even around. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who were involved in the original design have since passed. So, Your Honor, I do not believe that they could build you an identical sign to that. Also, there's been significant changes to this sign since it was originally constructed. It was built in 1993. MGM has had control of that sign and has had significant changes made to the sign since that time, as you can very well see today.
All right, Mr. Hunter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honors.
Okay, all right, we'll go to amicus now. We'll start with the Nevada Justice Association.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Therese Shanks. I'm here today on behalf of Amicus, Nevada Justice Association, which I will refer to as NJA. I would like to thank the Court for the honor of appearing at its first Amicus argument, which is also my first Amicus argument.
Did you volunteer for this job?
I did.
Or did somebody on the board say, hey, we have a great case, how would you like to take this on?
No, I actually volunteered. I thought this was an interesting issue. It's not one I'd encountered previously, and I really enjoy analyzing the history of the law as it goes through these various iterations of the restatement. In fact, my colleague brought up a very interesting point about the Callaway opinion. This month is the 20-year anniversary of that opinion, but this month is not actually the 20-year anniversary of that opinion. The Callaway decision was originally rendered in May 1997, and rehearing was filed in June 1997. The restatement third was published in 1998. Rehearing wasn't granted until 1999, and the Callaway decision that we are arguing over today was issued in February 2000. So at the time that Callaway was being decided, the third restatement was not available for those appearing before the Nevada Supreme Court. And given the fact that the Nevada Supreme Court tried very hard to define whether or not something was a product and specifically looked at the second restatement, is a fairly good indicia that Nevada should continue to look to the restatement as a definition for what constitutes a product. Whether the definition in the third restatement will answer the questions faced in this appeal before this court is a big question mark, because there are other issues at play which the third restatement's definition is designed to take into account. It is a very broad definition. It is personal property that is used commercially in commerce. And the commercial component is really the issue that the NJA focused on when we filed our amicus brief, because a lot of the cases that we saw, they don't actually say that just because something is unique, it can't be a product. What they are focused on is the issue that the court was presented with in the Queen City Court, where in Queen City, as Your Honor, Judge Tao, you brought up an excellent point. It doesn't appear from the record of this case that this is the only time AdArt will ever build a sign. But that Queen City case, that was the only time that manufacturer would ever build what they called a tank train, because the tank train was a patented, it was a patented car basically used to transport benzene, which is highly toxic. The company hired to make it was hired solely because they had a facility where the cars could be made that was close to where the benzene needed to be picked up and transported. They didn't make these types of cars. They'd never made these types of cars. They had to bring in additional people to help them make these types of cars. And when the tank trains were finally completed and they only ever made six in a one-time order, they never had the right to make them again. That's very different from a custom product, where you may never have the right to put that particular logo or design on that type of item, but you will still make another one of those types of items in the future. And the case law is ripe with examples of randomly conveyor belts. There's a lot of litigation over conveyor belts. Conveyor belts are often specially manufactured to meet that factory's design, to meet the width of the products that they are shipping out on those conveyor belts, to meet the machines that they have to go in between. And so there's a lot of case law, and we've cited most of it in our amicus brief, about companies that build one-of-a-kind conveyor belts. And One of the cases is the Zuniga case, which follows the Tank Train case out of Ohio, where they look at this company that said, well, you know, we build all these conveyor belts, but we're never going to build that conveyor belt again. And the Zuniga court, the Ohio Court of Appeals, said, but you still know, you still are in a better position to know what makes these conveyor belts safe, what safety processes, what warnings should be used, what products are good and are not good to put into it. And under those facts, it is very easy to see why the policies underlying strict liability would go in favor of holding a frequent manufacturer of custom goods liable under a strict products liability theory, rather than going along the analysis that if it's one of a kind, you can never be liable. Another question that this appeal raises, which is fascinating, is the real property. And that is something that Callaway has been a seminal case on. Since Callaway came out, there has been rampant litigation over strict products liability and real property. And when Callaway came out, there was rampant litigation on this issue as well. And footnote 5 of the Callaway opinion specifically notes that just because something is affixed to real property does not necessarily mean that it will lose its character. And that is not what the Nevada Supreme Court was addressing in the Callaway case, because the issue there, due to various settlements and the time that had passed from the original opinion, was solely the framing of the building. And so the Nevada Supreme Court specifically noted that something like an exploding HVAC system might be considered a product under the right purposes. And when you get to the third restatement also notes that there are going to be instances where even real property could be considered a product. My colleague noted these manufactured homes, mobile homes, which are not considered real property. They are considered personal property. They are often the subject of strict products liability. The fact that something is affixed to real estate cannot be the policy that a court adopts in governing and deciding whether or not that qualifies as a product for purposes of strict products liability.
So the test your counterpart is proposing is, yeah, maybe not just because it's affixed, like a dishwasher or, you know, a chandelier or whatever, but it's indivisible from the real property. What do you think of that test?
It would depend. There are going to be cases that differ on that. There is a split of authority. The restatement goes through them in the comments, and it discusses the difference between the house itself, which when you sell an APN, you sell the house, right, and the refrigerating unit, which can be easily detached. But it gets stickier when you're coming to things like flooring or light fixtures, things that people don't normally take with them when they go. And so then the question becomes, how do we analyze this under a strict products liability cases? And there are cases that have addressed these types of situations. We cited Keck versus Strivik, which found against finding siting of a home to be a strict products liability. My colleague cited Bodie versus Lighton, which found in favor of something being not strict products liability. And in both of those cases, courts with two very different approaches from different jurisdictions said, we don't know, so we're going to look at the policies underlying strict products liability, and we're going to decide whether it would serve the purposes. But what those courts unanimously said was, we are not going to apply the law of fixtures in the context of a strict products liability situation, because law of fixtures have very, very different underlying policies. The fixtures law is primarily contractual. It's similar to construction defect. I didn't get what I bargained for, or that belongs to me. There's not a remoteness. So the fact that something is affixed and might have to stay with the real property does not address the policy concerns a strict products liability poses.
You're doing a great job.
I'm talking a lot.
Yes. Keep going.
Oh, another interesting question, Your Honor, that you raised was the corporate changes. That is addressed in the Rawlings opinion that we brought in our amicus curiae brief. Rawlings is a California case. It's somewhat older. Rawlings dealt with a company that acquired another company, and after they had acquired that company's assets and liabilities, a product that the prior company had sold, which was a one-of-a-kind product, injured somebody. And Rawlings argued, number one, I can't be liable for that. Or I think Rawlings might actually have been the plaintiff. But in the Rawlings case, they argued, we can't be liable for that. It's one-of-a-kind, and also we didn't do it. We didn't build it. And the California Supreme Court said, we're not going to let you escape liability just because it's one of a kind if you make a lot of these one of a kind things. And also, if you make these one of a kind things, and that's why you bought the company, we need to look at the, you know, transaction that occurred between the two of you to determine whether or not you can be liable. That's not a strict products liability question. That's a proper party issue. But it's just that I didn't realize that was an overlapping fact. That was the Rawlings case.
So you're arguing that we should adopt the restatement thirds definition, and I actually kind of get the feeling that your counterpart doesn't necessarily disagree with that. So since the third restatement came out, which has been many years ago and now, how many states are actually following that?
Oh, that is a very good question. I don't know the answer to that, actually. I do know that the restatement third, when they created that definition, they canvassed all 50 states and came up with a definition that they felt merged what they were seeing happen statutory. My colleague mentioned the Model Uniform Products Liability Act, which Nevada has not adopted. But some states have, or iterations of it. And so the restatement third's definition is based upon what it saw occurring in all 50 states, whether it was products liability was a creature of statute in those states or common law. And the restatement third, they caution that it's an answer, but it's not necessarily a response because it's so fact-intensive whether something is or is not a product. And to, again, just continue to revisit the underlying policy. So while it is a definition and it's one that practitioners could use, it's still going to be a definition that requires a fact-based analysis of the facts before the court.
So, Ms. Shanks, would it be better for us when looking at this issue not to adopt a certain definition, but to apply the facts on a case-by-case basis to make the determination of whether or not it is a product at issue in the case?
It depends. The Callaway court didn't have a definition available to it, and what it reached is essentially the definition that the third restatement reached. So on one hand, it could make sense to only do the factor-based approach. On the other hand, even if you adopt the definition, you're probably going to do the factor-based approach, and it wraps up back around because strict products liability, unlike so many other areas of law, it's not bullet point policy driven. All of the policies are related and they flow together in a very interconnected way. So it's not just who was in the better position, but also how connected are we? You know, if we're further apart, then maybe they're in the better position if to guard against it. Whereas, you know, if I were to build a home, for example, I don't know the first thing about framing, but I can call my contractor. So that remoteness is not there. And that's why courts have been willing to close the gap in real estate. But those are two, quote unquote, separate policies. In this case, it might be beneficial to draw the line at whether or not Nevada will adopt a position on whether real property qualifies as a product, and if so, in what circumstances, because the third restatement limits it in the first sentence to personal property, but then notes that other things like real property and blood and tissue may qualify as products under the circumstances that they're equivalent to that. And those circumstances have varied across the jurisdictions. Almost all jurisdictions agree that if it's not a structural component, it's up for grabs as to whether or not it's a product. Some courts go pretty far into arguing that real property is always a product, even if the defects are caused by weather conditions or earthquakes. That would be California. And some jurisdictions lean more towards you have to be able to physically separate it and take it out. But in all of these cases, there's really no clear line. And in this case, I don't know enough about the MGM pylon sign.
Given that you have all these fact-intensive inquiries in the definition itself, so if we adopt the third restatement, tell me how this works. Who decides those facts? You have a motion for summary judgment, which occurs way before the trial. Does the court just say, well, these are all facts that the jury decide, or does the court make some threshold determination of what these facts are so that you can determine what legal threshold, strict liability versus negligence, applies?
And also, how does it work at trial? Do you just punt everything to the jury with a mess of jurors saying, if you find this, then you apply strict liability. If you find this, then it's general negligence, and you have this whole tree of jury instructions? Or does the court determine what these facts are and then say, okay, based on my determination, I'm only giving the strict liability instructions? How is that going to work?
The court determines it. It is one of the clearest things in the comments of the third restatement that whether something qualifies as a product is a threshold question of law to be determined by the court.
Ms. Shanks, do you believe the public policy concerns will be satisfied if the MGM pylon sign is treated as a product? And if so, could you explain why?
Yes. I wish I had known more of what the factual-based arguments would be. There are cases that treat billboard signs as personal property, and there are cases that treat them as products liability. There are no cases that discuss whether or not a sign is a product for purposes of products liability. So I did come across cases where I think when a billboard sign fell on a car, I did come across cases where it was almost assumed that these were items of personal property subject to products liability questions, but were decided on other bases. The one that I'm thinking of dealt with a highway system in which there was an immunity-ish question. So treating the MGM sign, that's very different from, you know, someone falling off the actual MGM itself. It's not part of the building. And signs generally are not part of the buildings. And Las Vegas is very unique in that, yes, we have these giant signs in Las Vegas, but we don't necessarily have those up north, my hometown, Reno. We have billboard signs. And the question, it seems a little bit less odd when it's a billboard versus a pylon sign, but the issues are still there. People can be injured by a sign falling from any height, from anywhere.
Okay, Ms. Shanks, thank you very much. We'll now turn to the Las Vegas defense lawyers. Ms. McLeod, maybe you want to introduce your co-counsel, too, that helped with the brief.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge, Judge Tao, Judge Bola. I am Alexandra McLeod. I serve on the board of directors for the Las Vegas Defense Lawyers, and I'm honored to be before you today to assist the court in answering the question posed about what the definition of product should be here in our state of Nevada. When the reasoning behind a rule does not apply, neither should the rule apply. Here, the definition of a product must be tailored to meet the judicial objectives and the policy considerations used to develop the doctrine of strict products liability. And because strict liability imposes responsibility without regard to fault, it must be strictly construed by the court. Contrary to what was proposed by the appellants in this case, whether or not the facts of this case fall under the definition of product is not the only measure of whether the citizens of Nevada will get justice. Strict liability is not the only remedy. There are other remedies available to the plaintiff, as well as to other citizens and to the consumers in Nevada. Strict liability is a special method of proof, a special remedy in order to address protections for consumers and particular problems of proof that happen in those cases. It does not preclude a victim or a consumer from seeking other remedies, for example, through a cause of action for negligence. As the Ohio court stated in the Queen City Terminals case, situations which would not further the judicial objectives have long been recognized to be outside the purview of strict liability. And so the court asked, is an issue of first impression, We've got a hard job to do to figure out what the definition will be in our state. And as the parties and the amicus have done, they've reviewed all the cases. There is the Callaway case, probably the best guidance we have in our state. But when we are trying to figure out a big problem, we look beyond that for borrowed wisdom from our sister states, from other jurisprudence. We've also examined the second, the third restatement of torts, as well as in the Las Vegas defense lawyer's amicus brief, the Model Uniform Product Liability Act.
Has that been adopted in any states in particular?
From my quick review of the brief and following up on that, knowing that it might be a question posed today, it seems that only a few states have adopted the Model Uniform Product Liability Act. But it does reflect a meeting of the minds of several experts in the field who have come together to try to answer the same question that's posed to the court today. Let's hash out what this definition should
and
be.
It seems to be the most conservative or restrictive definition. So what is the group that put this together?
The definition proposed by the defense lawyers is that a product is a manufactured good capable of traveling through interstate commerce, which would be exclusive of buildings and structures permanently affixed to land. That definition is basically an amalgamation from reviewing the case law as well as the restatements and the model code.
Ms. McLeod, I hate to even mention this, but there is something called the neon graveyard. And let us just suppose for a minute that the MGM is sold and another company buys the MGM Grand and they desire to have a new sign to reflect their new ownership. Can the MGM Grand sign as it exists today be taken down? And can it be put in the neon graveyard? Can it be moved?
Not at all.
And why do you say that?
Because a foundation was poured, and that sign is permanently affixed to the casino and to the real property underneath the casino.
So you don't think under any circumstances that sign could be moved? I'm not saying it wouldn't take some doing. I'm just asking, do you think that that sign under no circumstances could be moved? Or let's even say maybe not the pylon part of the sign, but the actual, for lack of a better term, the box of the sign, which I think we've used in some of the briefing or I've seen. And that's the part, of course, that the appellant fell through. Could that portion of the sign be removed and a new sign be placed? And could that old sign then be, you know, taken to the neon graveyard for everyone to see? I'm just trying to get an idea of how affixed this product is to the land.
I'm certainly not a construction expert, but I will try to address the court's question. I believe affixed to the sign and in the bright lights letters MGM on the top of the sign would probably be one of the component parts that could be disassembled and traveled over to the neon graveyard and somehow reconstituted and rewired so that it would light up for visitors to that facility. The entire 254 foot by 94 foot sign could not just be yanked out of the ground, put on the flatbed of a truck, and driven across town.
Well, this is what makes this case interesting, is a lot of these tests, they have these words, and, you know, like I mentioned to the one attorney, you know, this is about line drawing, right? I mean, everything's movable, it's just a question of how much you want to spend on it, right? When the, I don't know if you remember this, but a few years ago when NASA canceled the space shuttle program, they took a space shuttle, put it on a flatbed truck, even though it's bigger than the sign, and actually wheeled it through the streets of LA. There's photos of this on the internet. It's actually kind of an amazing endeavor. But it costs like $100 million to do that. So for $100 million, I bet someone can move the sign. So the question is, in this definition that you're proposing, movable, everything's theoretically movable, but what does that mean?
I think that is an astute question. to the court's point that anything could be movable. My parents are big fans of the show on HGTV called Texas Movers, where they move houses, not prefabricated mobile homes, but they figure out how to take a house off the slab, move it, put it on a new slab someplace else. So that court's point is well taken, that you can turn pretty much anything into being movable if you're willing to invest the time and money and manpower to do so. Looking at the third restatement, that definition is tangible personal property distributed commercially for use or consumption. I believe, and the defense lawyers would suggest, that the distributed part of that definition, goes directly to the question of how movable a good is in commerce. I think that also speaks to the Uniform Model Product Liability Act, which talks about capable of delivery and whether a good is movable. And that is where the capable of traveling through interstate commerce is part of the definition that we urge the court to consider.
Well, Ms. McLeod, this sign went through interstate commerce. It was manufactured in California and put on a flatbed truck and moved into Nevada. And then it was affixed to the property, and as I understand it, AdArt oversaw that particular process, and they did have to get permits to affix the sign to the property. But the sign itself was moved across state lines from California to Nevada, is that right?
The sign as a whole was not moved across lines. Parts of the sign that were eventually assembled on site, constructed here in Nevada, and what we're talking about now that the sign as a whole, right, we're going to that question that Judge Tao asked, where is that line between what when you buy a brick at Home Depot and when it becomes permanently affixed? Pouring the foundations, which have to be inspected, permitted, deal specifically with the soil here in the Las Vegas Valley. And honestly, if that sign were to be moved, there was some way to take the sign as a whole to the Neon Graveyard. You'd have to look at the soil there and have foundations poured there, which could be inherently different than the foundations that go to this sign, which goes to that part, the definition of how the mobility involved in a potential product. The law recognizes three types of property: intellectual property, chattels or personal property, and real estate. Even the definition from the third restatement separates products from two of those types of property. The first word in the definition is tangible. It means we're not talking about intellectual property. Then it says personal property. It means, hey, we're talking about chattels, not about real estate. I think the difficulty presented in the facts of this case is whether the court is going to find that the sign at the MGM fits into the personal property category or the real estate category.
So I think Judge Bula's question is this. This definition has a little bit of vagueness in it, and if I can take a little bit of restating what I think your question really was, it's a timing issue. Before this sign was installed at the site, it was more movable than it is now. Right? After it's installed, it's a little bit harder to move, although it's still probably theoretically movable for, you know, $100 million. So her question is, if AdArt were such a company, I'm going to hypothesize for a second. They make 100 of these signs, they're sitting in California in a warehouse right now, and they all weigh a ton, but they're all theoretically movable. Now, granted, after they're installed, they're no longer movable. But at this moment, sitting in the warehouse, are they products now? Because don't they meet the definition of they're movable, they're capable of delivery for direction to trade or commerce? They can be introduced now. After they're installed, maybe it's more difficult, but aren't they products now as they sit in the warehouse before they're embedded into the ground? I think that's your question. It's kind of a timing question. When does this definition even apply?
I think that the timing is important, and that is part of when, once the court decides what the definition should be, it's applying the definition to the facts of this case. what the amicus were asked to do is address the definition, but to the court's question, if a brick falls off the shelf at Home Depot and hits you in the head, that potentially could be a products case, it could be a premises liability case. Once that brick has been mortared in between other bricks and is in a chimney, if someone is somehow injured, that is perhaps a construction defect case. Maybe it's still a negligence case, but those bricks have changed when they become permanently affixed and not movable, or looking at the definition from the third restatement, easily distributed. When I made my opening remarks about the reason behind the rule, it's because the particular problems of proof that strict liability is designed to burden shift from away from the consumer and towards the manufacturer envisions a complicated and difficult problem of proof where you have a designer, a manufacturer, a wholesaler, a retailer, a distributor, trucking companies involved, and ultimately you have a point of end retailer and a consumer. That consumer who buys a product off a shelf doesn't know which batch it came from, doesn't know which of several factories it came from, and the only person with that superior knowledge would be much higher on this long, complicated chain. And so to ease that from a strictly from an evidentiary problem of proof, strict liability is created.
And then the problem with focusing on, you know, the number of products is, don't you get into a rule that says products that are really unpopular aren't products? Or products that are really expensive aren't products?
I think that in looking at specifically how to define products in our modern global economy, we need to look at how complicated that those problems of proof are. Here we have a contract between the MGM and the sign designer. There's no third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, potentially more parties in that chain. This was constructed on site. There's no question about, did this come from a factory in Maine? Did this come from a factory out of the country?
But Ms. McLeod, what are Mr. Schuller's options?
I'm sorry?
What are Mr. Schuller's options for recovery? If strict products liability doesn't apply, what are his options?
Negligence.
Okay.
Again, there's a premises, potentially a premises case between the owner of the real estate and the owner of the sign. They may have contractual rights to go back after the designer, right, in a third-party liability, but asking the manufacturer of a one-of-a-kind item affixed to land to bear responsibility without fault is beyond the reason for the development and the judicial objectives of strict liability in general.
Thank you very much, Ms. McLeod.
Thank you very much.
And we really appreciate the efforts from the Las Vegas defense lawyers and the Nevada Justice Association. We have one final presentation. Mr. Brensky, you have less than 3 minutes to wrap this up.
Thank you, Ron. Very briefly, even under the model code, the council for amicus listed. If you look at the model code, the definition of a product means any object possessing intrinsic value capable of delivery either as an assembled whole or as a component part or parts and produced for introduction into trade or commerce. That's what this sign did. They built it in pieces, they trucked it over, they put it on top. This what we're talking about, we're not talking about a 100,000-pound sign. We're talking about the little thing at the top where the guy went in to change some LEDs and fell through the floor. They changed the cube on the sign. They did this before. So this isn't something that is permanently affixed. They had changed part of that part of the sign had been changed. It became a different item. So it's something, it's like the bulb on a Christmas tree. They changed it. The ad art, the second one they put in, the floor is made of that bond that neither one of us can say, and he fell through it, and they should have warned that you're not supposed to walk on this part of the floor. It's as simple as that. The bottom line here is when you're talking about whether something is a product or whether it's real estate or not real estate, that sort of thing, the key is the overriding policy of tort law to promote safety. That's what this is about. It's about safety. Who is in the position to protect Mr. Buehler? It's not the MGM. They don't know how to make the sign. They just order it. Now, the case cited by counsel about an Illinois case, I would refer to the same court, Seeger Grain Company versus United States Steel Corporation, 218 Illinois Appellate 3rd. That case, they built a huge tank, and this tank exploded. And the reason it exploded is because they bought these steel plates from U.S. Steel. It turns out that they crack at really low temperatures, so the manufacturer of this structure didn't know that. U.S. Steel knew that. The thing blew up, and U.S. Steel was found responsible because of the plates that were welded onto this tank were defective. I mean, that's where we're at. When you look at Callaway, it talks about soil samples and all the different people involved in putting together a building and how it's confusing, and you know it's not should have an economic loss. But
you finish your thought.
Callaway is about economic loss in a construction defect case. That's not what this is. And Callaway even states in the footnote that real property could be subject to a product's strict liability. Thank you. Thank you all.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Bransky. This matter will now stand submitted for a decision from the court at a later point in time. Of course, we've been doing our own research in addition to everything you've given us. So with all the information that's been gathered, we feel like we're fully informed, and it's much appreciated, though, to have the input from all. We realize it's an important issue, and the options are fairly wide in terms of the definition, so we're looking at all of them. So,
yeah, I think also wanted to thank counsel for the NGA and the Las Vegas Defense Lawyers League, because to you guys, I'm imagining this is basically a pro bono case. You're not actually getting paid for this. It's somebody half the organization. So I wanted to thank you guys for taking the time and effort. And I know on a kind of question like this, which is a little bit unresolved in Nevada, there was a considerable amount of research that you guys probably spent on this. And so we should acknowledge that you guys and people in your firms took the time to do that without making any money on this, and it's helpful, and we wanted to thank you.
We really do appreciate it. This was an interesting issue for us, one that we were concerned about, one that we wanted input on, and we really appreciate not only the briefing but the timeliness of it and everyone being here today to assist us.
And we made you guys work close to the holidays with the schedule we had, and we wanted to thank you for accommodating us.
You're welcome, Your Honor. We appreciate the opportunity to participate, and I'll make sure to take the court's regards back to the organization.
Okay. And then what about your co-counsel? I thought you were going to introduce her. Ms. Gonzalez? So I know by some of the effort you put into the brief, and that certainly deserves some recognition, too.
She did the efforts that Judge Tao referred to with all the research and the writing. That was all Ms. Bianca Gonzalez, so we appreciate her very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, and make sure to thank all of your firms and all your partners as well, and for all the support that they gave all of you for helping us out.
And Ms. Shanks for coming here from Reno, too.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, we'll be in recess.